Jason Music, VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
On today's program, Dan Novak tells us about one environmental group's estimate of the number of species at risk of disappearing in the U.S. Brian Lynn presents this week's science report. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series. But first, here is Dan Novak.
An environmental group says 40% of animals and 34% of plants in the United States are at risk of disappearing. The group NatureServe recently released its report. The nonprofit group is based near Washington, D.C., in Arlington, Virginia. NatureServe said 41% of ecosystems in the country are also facing collapse. Ecosystems are everything that exists in an environment, including life forms, land, and water. Plants and animals of many kinds, including crayfish, cacti, and freshwater mussels, are in danger, the report said. The organization examined data from over 1,000 scientists in the United States and Canada. It said the report was its most complete yet, using 50 years of information on the health of animals, plants, and ecosystems. The report provides pictures and maps of areas that the group says are unprotected and where animals and plants are most threatened. Sean O'Brien is the president of NatureServe. He said the data in the report was terrifying. He hoped it would help lawmakers support legislation like the Recovering America's Wildlife Act, which failed to gain support last year. For example, among the species at risk of extinction is the Venus flytrap, a plant that eats insects. The report says it is only found in the wild in a few places in the states of North and South Carolina. NatureServe said that about half of all species of cacti in the U.S. are at risk of extinction. It said 200 species of trees might die out. The report also said that America's large northern grasslands are among the ecosystems most threatened. Over half of 78 kinds of grassland are at risk of collapse. The main threats to plants, animals, and ecosystems include environmental destruction, land use change, invasive species, damming and river pollution, and climate change. California, Texas, and the southeastern United States are where the highest percentages of plants, animals, and ecosystems are at risk. Those areas have many different forms of life. Wesley Knapp is the head plant scientist at NatureServe. He said those parts of America also have had a lot of population growth in recent years. Knapp said lawmakers usually do not provide as much money for plant conservation than they do for animals. The study said there are about 1,250 plants at serious risk of extinction. John Cantor is a biologist with the National Wildlife Federation a nonprofit group also based in Virginia. He was not involved in the report, but he said the data could guide state and area officials in creating effective state wildlife action plans, or SWAPs. Officials create SWAPs every 10 years to receive federal money to protect endangered species. Currently, $50 million in federal money is divided up among all states to carry out their SWAPs. The Recovering America's Wildlife Act would have increased that amount to $1.4 billion, or 28 times the current amount. Cantor said the bill would have increased states' abilities to protect plants and animals. Lawmakers who support the bill have said they would reintroduce it. Cantor added that the NatureServe report can guide officials on how to best spend the public's money. He said biodiversity, the presence of many different forms of life, is important. Our biodiversity and its conservation is like a nature savings account. And if we don't have this kind of accounting of what's out there, and how it's doing, and what are the threats, there's no way to prioritize action, Cantor said. I'm Dan Novak.
Astronomers have discovered 12 additional moons orbiting Jupiter. That means Jupiter now has a total of 92 moons, more than any other planet in our solar system. The new moons were recently added to a list kept by the internationally recognized Minor Planet Center. The center, operated by the International Astronomical Union, continually records the positions of planets, moons, and other space objects. Scott Shepard is an astronomer with the Carnegie Institution of Science. He was a member of the team that made the latest discoveries. Shepard told the Associated Press that the new moons were found using telescopes in Hawaii and Chile in 2021 and 2022. The first sightings were confirmed with additional observations. The latest moons are between 1 and 3 kilometers in size, he said. I hope we can image one of these outer moons close up in the near future to better determine their origins, Shepard added. Shepard has already taken part in 70 moon discoveries for Jupiter. He also discovered moons orbiting Saturn. Shepard noted that Jupiter's newly discovered moons have not yet been named. He said only half of them are big enough, at least 1.5 kilometers, to justify a name. In our solar system, some planets have numerous moons, while some have none. The American Space Agency, NASA, reports that Saturn had been the planet with the most moons until the most recent announcement. Saturn currently is known to have 83 moons. Saturn held the top position since 2019 when Shepard's team discovered 20 additional moons. Before that, Jupiter was the solar system's leader with 79 confirmed moons. Shepard told the AP he expects to keep adding moons to both Jupiter and Saturn in the future. Scientists believe Jupiter and Saturn's many small moons formed from crashes with larger moons, asteroids, or other space objects. Uranus and Neptune also have many small moons. But since those planets are much farther from Earth, discovering new moons orbiting those planets is more difficult, Shepard said. Saturn has two so-called ocean moons called Enceladus and Titan. The pieces of ice and rock that form rings around Saturn are not considered moons themselves, NASA said. But moons do exist within the planet's rings and help to keep the rings in line. Jupiter's moons include the largest in the solar system, Ganymede, an ocean moon called Europa, and a volcanic moon named Io. NASA notes that many of Jupiter's outer moons have what are called retrograde orbits. That means they orbit in the opposite direction that the planet spins in. Of the other major planets in our solar system, Uranus has 27 confirmed moons, while Neptune has 14. Mars has 2 and Earth has 1. Venus and Mercury have no confirmed moons. Earth's moon is thought to have formed when a large space body, about the size of Mars, crashed into Earth. Scientists believe material from the resulting crash came together to form our moon about 4.5 billion years ago. The huge gas planet Jupiter remains one of the most interesting for astronomers. Jupiter's atmosphere is made up mostly of hydrogen and helium. It orbits about 778 million kilometers from our sun. This year, the European Space Agency, ESA, plans to launch a spacecraft to explore Jupiter. The Jupiter Icy Moons Explorer spacecraft, called JUICE, is expected to launch sometime in April. The mission will make detailed observations of Jupiter and its three large moons. ESA says it hopes the observations will help scientists learn more about Jupiter's complex environment as they use the planet as a model for other gas giants across the universe. I'm Brian Lynn.
Now, Brian Lynn joins me to talk more about his science report this week. Hi, Brian. Thanks for being here.
Sure. Glad to be here, Ashley.
In today's report, you explored new developments surrounding the planet Jupiter. You described the discovery of 12 new moons around this very large gas planet. First of all, how and when did researchers find these moons?
Well, the scientific team involved in this project said it used two different telescopes to confirm the existence of the 12 new moons. One is the Subaru telescope, which operates from a mountaintop in Hawaii. It uses infrared technology to observe planets, moons, and other space objects. The other is called the Dark Energy Camera, which is part of a 4-meter instrument that operates from a mountain in northern Chile. All the new discoveries were made over the past few years and just announced recently.
Okay, and how important do the scientists think these discoveries are?
So one of the main researchers was Scott Shepard with the Washington, D.C.-based Carnegie Institution of Science. He noted that studying a planet's moons can help scientists learn more about the planet a certain moon is linked to. And such studies can also lead to new information about what is happening in the area of space where these moons form. Sometimes violent crashes between space objects can create these moons.
The story points out that the number of moons surrounding a planet can change quite often. But Earth, for example, still has just one. What other planets are known to have numerous moons?
Well, the next one down on the list is Saturn, which currently has 83 confirmed moons. The ice giant Uranus has 27 confirmed moons, while Neptune, also an ice giant, has 14. And it is interesting to note that while Saturn was the previous holder of the most moons, the number one spot was held by Jupiter before that. And we also note in the story that Venus and Mercury have no confirmed moons at all.
Okay, well, thanks again for joining me on today's program, Brian.
You're welcome. Thank you, Ashley.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In our last program, we told you how the flow of immigration to the United States began to change in the 1880s. Before then, most of the immigrants came from Central and Northern Europe, from Britain, Ireland, Germany, and the Scandinavian countries. The largest number came from Britain. They found it easy to settle in a country that, until 1776, was a collection of British colonies. The newcomers from Britain shared the same language with the Americans and many of the same traditions. Some of these early immigrants were skilled workers who found good jobs in American industry. Others were farmers who came to America for free land. Robert Bostick and Jack Weitzel continue the story of immigration in the United States.
After 1880, the flood of immigration from Northern and Central Europe began to fall. Now, most immigrants were coming from Eastern and Southern Europe, from Russia, Poland, Romania, Italy, Greece. These new immigrants were different from those who came earlier. Most did not speak English. Most were poor farmers who had few special skills. Most had little or no education. They were, however, good workers. They did not protest working long hours for low pay. They did not demand better working conditions. They usually refused to join labor unions or take part in strikes.
American factory owners were pleased with the new immigrants. They gave them jobs formerly held by higher-paid American workers. The owners asked the new workers to write letters to friends still in the old country, urging them to come to America. And they came by the hundreds of thousands to take jobs in steel factories in Pennsylvania and the coal mines of West Virginia. They worked in the lumber camps of Michigan and in the stockyards and the meatpacking plants of Chicago. American workers then began to protest as their jobs were filled by immigrants who were happy to work for less money.
The protests were especially bitter on the Pacific coast, where thousands of Chinese immigrants were settling in California. The Chinese arrived there after 1850 to help build Western railroads. After the railroads were completed, these Chinese newcomers turned to other jobs. More came every year. By the 1870s, California's political leaders were demanding an end to further immigration from China. In 1882, Congress passed a law that barred Chinese immigration for 10 years. The law was extended for another 10 years, then made permanent.
The immigration law of 1882 put other limits on immigration. It closed the country to criminals, the mentally ill, and persons who could not support themselves. Later, others were added to this list: persons with diseases, anarchists, alcoholics. This, however, did not greatly reduce immigration from Eastern and Southern Europe, and opponents of immigration demanded stronger action. Some proposed a literacy test. Immigrants would have to show that they could read and write. An immigrant who could not would not be permitted to enter the country.
Senator Henry Cabot Lodge of Massachusetts urged Congress to pass such a law. In a Senate speech, Lodge said, "If we care for the welfare, the wages, or the standard of life of American working men, we should take immediate steps to limit foreign immigration. There is no danger to our working men from the coming of skilled workers or of trained and educated men. But there is a serious danger from the flood of unskilled, ignorant foreign labor. This labor not only takes lower wages, but accepts a standard of living so low that the American working man cannot compete with it." Senator Lodge continued, "A literacy test will bear very lightly, if at all, upon English-speaking immigrants or Germans, Scandinavians, and French. The races which would suffer most under a literacy test would be those with which the English-speaking people have never united, and who are most different from the great majority of the people of the United States." Congress passed the proposal. President Cleveland, however, vetoed it. He said the nation had nothing to fear from immigrants who could not read or write. He said there was greater danger from some of the educated immigrants who urged violence and anarchy. It took a number of years before Congress was able to pass a law demanding a literacy test for immigrants.
Another problem troubled President Cleveland: high tariffs, taxes on imports. Soon after his election, Cleveland decided to learn what he could about the tariff. "I'm sorry to say," said Cleveland, "but the truth is, I know nothing about the tariff." Cleveland studied all the information he could find about the tariff. He found that the tariff was used not only to get money for the government, but to protect American industry from foreign competition. The tariffs had been raised so high that they were producing more money than the government needed. Cleveland decided that high tariffs were wrong. He told other Democratic leaders that he would try to get them reduced. The politicians warned him not to try. They said he would only lose the support of businessmen. They said he would need campaign money from business if he expected to be elected president again. But Cleveland rejected their advice. He said, "What is the use of being elected or re-elected if you don't stand for something?"
So, late in 1887, Cleveland sent a tariff message to Congress. He said it was wrong to raise more tax money than the government needed. "When this happens," he said, "money is withdrawn from the people's use and kept in the public treasury where it does no good. It threatens the economy and invites dishonest attempts to use the money for private interests. The government," he said, "received most of this unnecessary tax money from tariffs." He said the present tariff laws were vicious, unfair, and illogical. He said they raised the prices of all imported goods which could be taxed. They also led American manufacturers to raise their prices as high as those charged for imported goods. Cleveland said some men had become rich because protective tariffs let them charge high prices. He noted that American businessmen like to talk about the strength and success of American industry. But he said that when the question of the tariff is raised, businessmen claim that industry is weak. They say they cannot compete with low-priced foreign products.
Cleveland said he did not propose that all tariffs be ended. He said some were needed to raise money for the government. And he said some industries could not exist unless they were protected by tariffs. But he said tariffs should not let some industries make huge profits. Cleveland warned that it would be far better to make safe, careful, and intelligent changes in the tariff laws now. Otherwise, he said, there might come a time when an angry public would demand radical and sweeping changes.
The House of Representatives moved quickly to pass a moderate bill that would reduce many of the tariffs. The legislation, called the Mills Bill, was exactly what Cleveland wanted. But the bill ran into trouble in the Senate, where Republicans had control. Senator William Allison, a Republican from Iowa, proposed a different tariff bill. It was one that would increase tariffs, not reduce them. The Senate debated the tariff question for months, and since it was 1888, a presidential election year, the tariff became an important election issue. The Democrats promised low tariffs that would mean lower prices for the people. The Republicans defended high tariffs, which they said were necessary to protect American industry and labor. The Democrats nominated Grover Cleveland for another 4-year term. The Republicans held their nominating convention 2 weeks later.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan.